So welcome, Nurse KB. I'm so pleased to have you. You were part of a competition that where we ran asking people to contribute ideas that they had in terms of interesting topics to talk about. We really loved your energy and we loved the topics that you chose. So I'm very pleased to have you on and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And I think the biggest thing with my entry and just what I like to talk about in aesthetics in general is how do we dispel some of these stereotypes and stigmas that are still very present in our community and present in aesthetics. So thank you not only for this opportunity, but for allowing us to talk about this on a greater scale, because I think it's a really important conversation to have with patients and providers.
Yeah, I think it's super valuable. I think it's really helpful. So most of my audience are clinicians themselves, and but there are lots of patients as well. But I think the stuff that you've touched on is probably one of the number one reasons why patients don't actually book, is because they are worried about these other ideas that float out there. And to understand them gives you, you know, forewarned is forearmed. You, if you can understand what patients are going through and the kind of things that you're talking about highlights that, then you can better talk to them on their level and alleviate some of those fears. Because actually the stigma follows people all the way through into the consultation room. And I discovered this many times that patients are often holding back the truth for fear of judgment. And if you can be the kind of clinician who can alleviate those fears, you succeed better and your patients like you more. And so everyone's a winner. So let's dive into this interesting topic. Tell me a little bit about what you first noticed that got you thinking about the stigmas. What sort of experiences have you had?
Yeah, I think I want to start off with like my own experience with it too. You know, I didn't start getting Botox. I just turned 29 until this year, because it was always something when I grew up in Southern California, right in between LA and Orange County during the 2000s, right when Botox Cosmetic just got approved by FDA. So I definitely had my own stereotypes and my own preconceived notions of what aesthetics look like, and kind of the bad part of aesthetics mostly. So for me, kind of what I wanted to do as I entered this industry and entered my practice was to understand why. Like, why do we do the things that we do with aesthetics as a patient, as a client? And for me, you know, whenever I start a consultation, it's never what areas do you want to get treated? It's always, you know, what brought you to my chair or what brought you to get to Botox? And patients will often always start off saying like, you know, I don't like my 11s. I don't like my crows. Hey, I learned about the lift lip on Instagram or TikTok. Can you get these? But throughout the course of the conversation, before I even start my assessment, it starts to get personal and they start to talk about, you know, I've been a nurse through the pandemic and I've seen a lot. So I hold a lot of tension in my forehead, or you know, I just want this to be very preventative and I want to make sure that my skincare routine matches how I take care of my muscles and my skin. But my big aha moment came really early on as I started injecting. And this client came to me saying that they had gone through a year of traumatic experiences and they held a lot of sadness and a lot of grief in their forehead, and that they wanted to seek out Botox as a way to feel like themselves again, that they wanted to look in the mirror, feel confident again, and not hold the past in them. And I think that for me was the moment of, we all have a reason why we do this. I think what social media and what society presents is a very vain and very one-sided aspect of the aesthetic industry and why people get it. But truly, so many of our clients and so many of our patients look to us as providers and look to injectables or aesthetic treatments as a way to feel like themselves again. And I think that's such an important conversation to have, not only with our clients, but also as fellow providers.
Absolutely. I love that you figured it out. And it's funny, I just had a message yesterday from Nurse Jenna, and she was saying, particularly around the word grief, that she has now, because she's figured out what you figured out as well, that you start to see it on patients' faces, not just about aging, it's about an expression of some pain that they've been through. And they often see you just at the moment where they're ready to bounce back. I actually think it's a very, you don't want to treat someone in the midst of a storm, but after it's settled down, there's often a point where they kind of are still carrying the sadness, but they're ready to look to the future again. And that's often when we first meet them. And I love that you've picked that up, because for me as well, that's the heart of what aesthetics is about the patient story and the real reasons that they're doing it, which is nothing like what people portray it. It's often, and it's great. I must also applaud you for figuring this out. You're still 29, or you,
Yes.
Anyway, yeah. So, because I was, it took me a while to really get to the depth of understanding this, but it really puts you on exactly the right path to what we're actually trying to do with aesthetics. And it's fantastic that you figured that out. What do you think patients think is the main stigma around having treatments?
A lot of them will say, I just want to look like myself. And I think that's something that we all experience, whether it be neuromodulators, semi-permanent, permanent fillers, or even as you go into the invasive aesthetics, you know, people just want to look like themselves again, whether that's, you know, looking like themselves now and preventing their wrinkles down the line, or, you know, they want to look like themselves a couple of years ago and not necessarily having the conversation of like, I want to look younger, but I still want to look youthful. I still want to look like myself. Whenever I have those late 20s, early 30s clients that really are looking to Botox as a preventative measure, you know, they'll often say, you know, I don't want to look frozen. I mean, it's one, respecting that, but also understanding and educating them that, you know, to get to a certain level or to get to a certain image requires a lot more than what we're doing currently. So I think that's probably the biggest thing is our face and the decision to, you know, put needles in our face or Botox is a very personal decision that we don't want. We don't want to mess that up. We don't want to look like something that's not authentically us.
Yeah, that's another great point, because I figured out as well at a point that people thought I was constantly trying to change faces, but more often I'm actually just trying to keep them back with how they started. So they want to look the same. As you say, they want to look like themselves. And that's also not what I think people who are outside of the industry think. They think they're all trying to change themselves and look different, whereas often it's just I'm trying to match my image of who I am for as long as possible. Do you notice patients carry in judgment with them? I'm interested in what it's like where you are, because California, from a British perspective, you guys are way ahead of us. Like, you guys have been leading the way on on these kind of treatments. And it might be interesting sort of comparing and contrasting. Do you hear that patients still feel like there's something inherently bad about cosmetic treatments, or that they're bad for you in some way? Is that still part of the narrative, even when they come and see you?
I think in some aspects of it, you know, I will still have those conversations in some early consultations of, oh, you know, Botox will really mess up my face. And it's, again, educating them about the pathophysiology of what a neuromodulator is. It's, you know, it is temporary. These results don't last. And it really is something that you have to maintain. So one, I think as we educate individuals more, whether it's in consultations or even on social media, and we can get into that later about like social media and really changing the perspective of aesthetics, but also giving some really bad information out there too. But I think it's shifting a little bit more. I think we're talking about it more so in our day-to-day lives of when you think about your skincare regimen, it's not just your vitamin C's, moisturizer, SPF. Botox, fillers are a part of that conversation now, I think, with a lot of my colleagues and a lot of my friends. But I think what is interesting with California, again, going back to living in Southern California during the rise of Botox, is if we look at the dynamics of the industry and the population, the generation specifically that is looking to aesthetics, it's the millennial population, you know? And that population are the ones who, during their formative years, early teens, young adults, really went through a lot of the craze and went a lot through, you know, the Y2K, the rise of Botox, the rise of social media and reality television and celebrities like Housewives or the Kardashians, whatever it may be, and really went through the development of social media. So I think a lot of us having hesitations going into aesthetics for the first time is deeply rooted in how we grew up in those environments that we grew up in that really made an impression on us of, you know, when everything first started out, it was botched Botox, botched, you know, cosmetic procedures. And we only saw that side of it, or we saw the side of somebody getting a treatment and it really just didn't look like them. So I think that is still a part of a lot of our day-to-day conversations with clients, even just friends of mine when we talk about aesthetics. But it definitely is something that is more widely understood. You know, Botox cosmetic has been on the market, 21-ish years now? So we've learned a lot more and we've progressed a lot more and we'll continue to progress in learning more about how Botox works and, you know, how we can use it effectively in different ways. But I think here in California, it is something that has just become a part of the lexicon of skincare regimens.
Do you still have patients who are reticent to have injectables, but will have other things because of what they are afraid it says about them to have an injection? You know, they like skincare, maybe even lasers, but they won't do the injectables.
Yeah. I had a client who came to me for their first time getting Botox. And, you know, I always just like asking, you know, what is your skincare regimen? What have you done so far to maintain? And they're like, oh, I've done Morpheus. I've done microneedling. I've done, you know, the Fraxel laser and everything. But like, yeah, but I'll stay away from the injectables. And it's just an interesting conversation to have of like, you'll do a 10-step skincare routine plus a microneedling regimen plus facials plus all this, but where's the fear in injectables? And I think, again, that goes back to this individual grew up in California as well. So I think there's still that hesitation of something being botched with an injectable.
So yeah, I think there's a combination, because I have that as well, but there's a combination of the fear of the outcome, but also the bit that I find quite interesting is sometimes they feel like it's making a statement about themselves that they don't want to make. Like, I'm the kind of person who has Botox. For some people, triggers like some sort of, there's a story in the head, which obviously we don't share, that means that they're a worse person because of that. Yeah. It's something to do with, you know, the whole idea of vanity or something unhealthy about an injection versus a cream, yeah. Like the lengths you'll go to as if it's a huge thing. But because I remember getting to the bottom of this with a patient and saying, so let me get to the bottom of this. If I was to wave a magic wand and give you this result, you would have it, but you don't. It's the nature of how it's given and the story behind it that you don't like. And she was like, yeah, that's it. I do want the result. I just don't want to have. So that was quite an interesting moment where we kind of separated the two aspects, because it's the, and for her, it was around this idea of what kind of person, the stereotype, which you mentioned, mm-hmm. which is always, it's always the way with stereotypes, isn't it? That they are the most extreme and actually quite a small part of the overall picture, but they are, because they're so extreme, we remember them.
Yeah. And especially, I think social media has a lot to do with that. You know, it amplifies the good, which is great. You know, we have some amazing providers like yourself and business people like Miranda who are helping pave the way in, you know, creating an environment and an industry that is more inclusive, that is more educated about injectables. But there is also that other side, like you mentioned, you know, everyone likes to, I always have clients who will pull up pictures of Spock brow, or, you know, will show, you know, their friend on Instagram and how they don't like the way that, you know, their crows are done, or that they've gotten too much lift in their lateral brow. So as much as I think social media has done a great job in educating patients and clients, it also has really amplified the bad side of it, of, you know, how often do we see someone posting or reposting of like, this is why I don't get injectables, you'll get Spock brow, or, you know, lidtosis, whatever it may be. I think that also too has a hand in an understanding the risk and benefits of why you're getting injectables.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because I have the complication side of stuff and the negative side, a lot of people are kind of really against, at least years ago, were much more against putting stuff out like that. But my perception from a clinical side is that it's been a huge benefit in terms of upgrading everyone. Because there was a time when, in fact, when I first trained, a long time ago now, 15 years ago, there was no mention of necrosis on my training program. And there was no mention of vascular occlusion. No, there was a mention of necrosis, but not of vascular occlusion. So they just listed, I still got the PowerPoint where it was like, bleeding, bruising, infection, necrosis, and then next slide, and we never talked about it again, and that was it. Now, the great thing about social media is it's made it impossible to hide from those potential negatives. Like, it's so pervasive that we talk about these things, and the patients even share their own negative outcomes. That now, if you run a training program, there is no way that you can run that training program without touching on these subjects. So although it's an initial negative, I think it's something about grounding yourself in the truth. I think what patients struggle with is what is the actual probability of them having that outcome. And it's hard. It's very hard to know. So what are the things that your patients say that they are most afraid of when they, you know, the kind of patient who comes in who's teetering, like, should I even be here? What are the things that they are most reserved about?
Spock brow is definitely the biggest thing. I think, you know, it's something that's obviously very noticeable. I've had clients who want to get lift lip or their mentalis done, but they will always show a picture of somebody with like a lopsided smile. Cause I mean, the smile is probably one of the first things that you see as an individual. And I think when it comes to heaviness in the eyes and treating the frontalis, I'll have a lot of patients come in like, oh, I just want to treat the frontalis. I don't want to treat my 11th. Mike, let's, you know, again, education. Let's talk about why we're treating certain areas together and how the anatomy and mechanisms of our muscles work. You know, oftentimes as I start educating them through that process, they're like, oh, I didn't know that. You know, if you treat my glabella, then the depressor will go down. If you only treat my frontalis, then my really strong glabellar complex will really give me some heaviness that I don't like. But those are kind of the biggest things are smile, spot brow, as well as only treating the frontalis and getting rid of the lines and educating them through that process.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like that is your strategy. Once they, if they have a reservation, is you go straight down into education and explain it all, which is exactly what I do. And it's very good practice in terms of your own understanding is to come up with better and better quality answers to those particular reservations. Because I've seen clinicians, sometimes very experienced clinicians, just dismiss this stuff and just say, no, it doesn't work. We never do that. You always have those two areas treated together. And it can work with a minority of patients, but patients really value that knowledgeable explanation where you bring them with you rather than just using your status as a clinician to kind of almost just dismiss and bully them into the thing that you think is right. They really love that explanation.
Yeah, and I think along with that too, one of the reasons I really do ask all my patients, what led you to get Botox or why are you here in my chair today? Because a lot of them will trust your expertise. A lot of them will just say like, hey, Tim, you're the expert. What do you think I need to get done? And for me, it's never about what I think you need to get done. Because I think that also changes the dynamic of like, oh, I think this is wrong with you. So I'm going to treat this versus, hey, I really want to understand what you want to get treated. Like what in your day-to-day life has led you to get Botox? You know, is it you don't like seeing the lines on your forehead? Is it because you have really deep crows that you don't want to get any deeper or whatever it may be? But I think having that question as experts and as clinicians first of what do you want to get treated? Why are you here? Versus just having them sit down and start poking them and prodding them, because that's not a, you know, grateful. That's not a great experience either. And I actually had this one client who they were talking about their first experience getting Botox before at you know, one of those franchise med spas. And they felt like almost defeated coming out of it. You know, they had explained that the injector had just really pointed out all the areas that they did not want to get treated. And they felt like crap coming out. Like, wait, what is wrong with my face? What just happened? Did I get the right areas treated? And I think that does a disservice to all of our clients because, you know, you really should listen. You should really understand why they're coming to you and not use your expertise against them.
Mm-hmm. 100%. We're entirely from the same page book on that. I feel for me, that's actually one of the big things I'd like to contribute to is clinicians doing it the way you've just described. Because the strange thing is, that it often doesn't mean that you don't get to talk about those other areas, but you do it in a way that's in alignment with what the patient wants. And it feels like a service as opposed to just being beaten down. Like, because it can actually, you just need that permission and you need to orient it around why they're there, as you say. Because most patients would love the result, but not when it's pitched as here's what's wrong with your face. Instead, it's like, okay, you want to feel like you did when you were younger. You want to look fresher, more like yourself. Mm-hmm. Can I give you some potential ways to do that? That feels so different, even though it's the same information, and it's actually quite a simple change. Yeah. It has to be done with integrity, and to actually be behind your patient's success in life is the underlying principle. So if you get excited, and I actually think most clinicians do this, you know, we all remember the patients who cried when they have a treatment because they're so happy, and you feel so great about your job and what you can achieve. Now, what I try and teach people is what you're already doing, which is bring that to the center of your consultation, find out what's going to make them feel that way, and then see if you can achieve that result. And then everyone's a winner. And it often also means you get to do all the treatments that you want to do, but they're presented in a way that patients actually feel validated instead of invalidated.
Exactly.
So yeah, that's fantastic that you're thinking this way. And I'm really pleased to be able to share this kind of insights with our audience, because I think most people, so I actually once had consultation training, I won't say with who, but with a very famous person. And it was pitched as consultation training. And then when we went to go and do the consultation, he said, well, you do the consultation. And I started asking questions. And then he interrupted me and he's like, what are you asking these questions for? And then he just started telling the patient what they need. And I was like, wow, that's really different to what I thought consultation was. At the time, I remember, you know, because it was quite early on, and I remember thinking, well, maybe there's something I don't know, because I was the junior one there. And as I look back on that, I realized, no, like I knew how to do a consultation better than this expert. He may be an amazing injector, but it's not the way to bring someone with you. It works when you're a god, you know, but none of us actually are gods. Like if you create that online and patients are like, yeah, I'll do whatever you want. You know, they hand themselves over on a platter. I think you eventually get caught out by that, because you eventually get a complication, and then they actually don't want, they know you're not a god, and they had a treatment they didn't even believe in. And then you end up in much more difficult situations. So I'm always the least important person in the room trying to facilitate the thing that's most important for my patients. And that's exactly what your message is as well, from what I'm hearing.
And I think too, as clinicians, we need to not be afraid of saying no. You know, when I do a consultation and they're like, oh, I just want this, this, and this, and this, I'm like, eh. I don't think with anatomy and how Botox works that will figure out our problems. You know, a lot of what my clients will say, like, oh, I want my nasolabial folds fixed with Botox. I'm like, let's talk about this a little bit. You know, why do we use Botox versus filler, and what are the areas that we would treat? Because if I were to put Botox right here, you'd get a far different result than you would with filler. So I think it's really important also for us clinicians to have that integrity and say, I don't think this is the right treatment for you, or I don't think this is the right way to go about aesthetics to get the results that you want. And I think really pushing people in the right direction too, because again, social media really does inflate the way that we look at things. So, you know, I'll have clients that will want, you know, the world, but really don't understand the mechanisms of neuromodulators. And say, I had this one client once saying that they wanted to get their master's done for TMJ, but they're saying that they hold their tension really high up, that they want the injection higher up on the cheek, without knowing that, you know, we had the complications of hitting the resorius the higher that we get. And I actually use your tip on marking a lot lower, have great success on doing masseter Botox because of it. But again, it's really saying, hey, I understand that you have an idea of what you want this treatment to look like, but let's kind of talk through these concerns. Let's talk through these areas and how can we effectively inject them or manage them without getting into other complications. So I think it's really important for us as clinicians to really not use our education, not use our training to the advantage that we start making mistakes for patients. I think saying no is a really hard skill to have, but it's a really important skill to have, especially if we're talking about treating the face and something that is so out there. And if you make a mistake, you'll see it.
Mm-hmm. What I love about your response, once again, is you've demonstrated that you respond when they ask for the wrong thing with more education. And that's such a lovely way to say no, because you're educating them as part of the process, and you're not dismissing the request as stupid, which is what I see a lot of clinicians, particularly actually more senior ones, who almost say the question is stupid, like this person is stupid for asking, or they've been tricked by something, and it diminishes them. Whereas you're actually saying, your question is not stupid. Your desire is not stupid, but here's why it won't work, with a really good explanation. And that makes your patient feel empowered, and they've found someone who's actually, and it's also something I think took me a while to really take on board, which is the patients, although they come and ask for treatment, the thing they value more than treatment is someone who's an expert guide. So when you demonstrate expertise by doing exactly what you're talking about, you actually educate them at the point of asking, making a mistake, so that they don't make a mistake. That becomes more valuable than the treatment. And this is one of the secrets of separating yourself. I've been hearing a lot about how in the US you guys have a lot of chains that are spreading.
Yeah.
Now, one of the ways to stand and maintain your autonomy in the face of chains might be just, or even within a chain, even if you work within one, but to become the clinician that patients want to see is exactly with this approach of continuously educating and making them realize that you're much more than just someone who holds the needle, which is perfect.
Exactly.
Do you have patients who reference other people's judgment in the consultation as well? Do you ever have someone where they bring a third person in and what the third person might think?
I actually had, so a big part of my business is I do Botox parties. You know, I think it's one, a very intimate environment to be around friends, especially for first timers, you know, because going into a med spa can be very, very intimidating. You know, like you're going into this foreign environment, not necessarily knowing who's going to inject you, not necessarily knowing what's going to happen. So, you know, I really enjoy Botox parties because it's an environment that's relaxed, but or with friends. But with that comes those side conversations. So a couple of weeks ago, I had, you know, a group of like five clients and I was doing the consultation, doing my regular, hey, you know, what is it that you're looking for? What brought you here today? And one of the friends interjected and say like, I think they really need to get their forehead done. I think they really need to get this done. And I'm like, wait, hold up. Okay. I was like, let's have this conversation with this individual getting a treatment. Like I know you have your needs and you have your perspectives and perceptions of what needs to be done, but I really want to be able to know from the client themselves, like what are the areas that you want to get treated? I mean, you know, after a little bit of digging, I think needing to spend, it's important for us to spend that time, even if it's an extra 2, 3, 5 minutes to really understand the areas that they want to get treated or why they're getting treated, because everything that their friend said and pointed out was far different than what they wanted. They really wanted something more preventative, more conservative in the terms of dosage and where they're getting treated, whereas their friend was wanting them to do a full face rejuvenation. So I think it's really important, again, to say no and to really focus back on the client and say, what do you want in those kinds of situations? Because, I mean, they inevitably happen, but when I'm treating you as an individual, I'm treating you. I'm not treating your friend. I'll treat them with whatever they want after, but with you, I want to focus on you.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I find the three-person consultation, I call it the three-person consultation. Sometimes they're not even in the room, but it's the dynamic of someone else influencing things can both help lubricate things, but it can also make them worse. Like it can be quite helpful, you know, when someone's in the room and they've said they want it and then they're kind of umming and ahhing and shouldn't I? And they say, you deserve it. Just a simple, like, you deserve it helps them. Like, yeah, I do deserve it. I'm going to go after it. Now I've never orchestrated that, but you do have it. And then you have, the people who aren't in the room, like the husband who doesn't back this and thinks it's going to make everything look worse. Often a lot of men are afraid that their wives or partners will change. And they put the brakes on it for that reason, which is very hard to manage, but you have to prepare your patient for that resistance when they go home. So if you are clear as an individual, you want this treatment, how are you going to address this with your partner when they notice, assuming they will notice, mm-hmm. which by the way, if you don't do that and they do notice, the partner wants to sabotage the result and they'll say, oh, it looks worse. And then you have to deal with the marital issue. So it's super interesting. The interesting thing about a group, so I've done something similar, which we used to do demonstration evenings. So people would come who were interested. I'd already prearranged a patient who I would demonstrate a procedure on. And then they would make a decision if they wanted a treatment. But the way that room went, it could go one way or the other. Like you have one person in the room who's really against some aspect of it. And we'll start to try and sabotage the whole event. And it does, it shifts people's, because they feel like they start to feel afraid. What's it saying about me if I say I want this? And sometimes it starts a healthy debate and kind of people thrash out what are the real philosophical issues we're all having here with trying to control our appearance. But it's very different to one-to-one consultations. And I guess with the other thing you're getting in that situation is anyone who's gone, you would think that mostly they are already on board and supportive with the idea. Have you ever had anyone in one of these situations who was not really into the idea, who was kind of trying to persuade people in the other direction?
Yeah. And I think too, I still get a lot of clients, whether they're male or female, of like, oh, I don't want my before and afters on your Instagram because I don't want my partner to know. I don't want my family to know. And I think, again, talking to them through that experience, it's, you know, why? You know, I think if it's something that makes you feel authentic, it makes you beautiful, like that's the conversation you should be having. Because whether it's filler or Botox, you're doing aesthetics or you're seeking out aesthetics because you want to feel confident. And to your point too, it's, you know, you've made the decision, you want to do this for yourself, feel empowered to make that decision for yourself. But I've had an instance where when I was treating somebody in their home, they're like, oh yeah, you know, this is the time that my partner is not going to be home. Their partner had walked in and I'm like mid-injection. I'm like, okay, what's happening? But, you know, talking through that and, you know, I'm not trying to get into their personal business or, you know, their partnership, but, you know, I just explain it in the way of she feels beautiful. This is what makes her feel authentic. And I think this is something that both of y'all can benefit from, because what I find with aesthetics is it's kind of that tried and true statement of when you look better, you feel better. When you feel better, you show up better. And I truly believe that whether it's aesthetics, getting your hair done, you know, getting your nails done, buying a new outfit, whatever it makes you feel confident, you know, it allows you to show up better in those relationships, those friendships, into your work environment, into your hobbies. So, you know, kind of shifting that perspective for the partner of saying, I know we have these ideas of Botox. Trust me, I have them too. And every day I'm still trying to dispel them and trying to check my subconscious of why do I think this way? But she feels beautiful. This is what makes her feel whole. This is what makes her feel confident. Can we support it at least for that? We may not, you know, respect or agree with the modality that reaches that result, but at the end of the day, it makes them feel like themselves. And that's something that I think universally we can all agree on. Like, we all just want each other to find joy, find happiness, and feel confident. It's not up to us to decide for you how you do that.
Yep, absolutely. There, I've figured out that there are, roughly speaking, there are three different categories of partner. The most common is, I don't really understand it, but if it makes her happy or him happy, then fair enough. Which I think is quite a neutral. It's kind of the neutral position. Yeah. The worst one is the one who's behind the treatment. And strangely, I've actually had this more with women bringing their husbands than the other way around. But the one I always remember is a husband who brought his wife, as if she was like a broken car. I was like, what can you do about this? Mm-hmm. And he was, and it, you know, it's really jarring but they had a very special relationship. She gave as good as she got. But, and then of course the one that we deal with, I think the most is the partner who's against it, but isn't in control of it, who then tries to get control through sabotage later on. And those are the ones to be careful of. And we don't have to do much except prepare the patient for that, because they're free individuals, as you've said. It's up to them. You just need to, the only thing I would say is don't let them leave hoping they will get away with it. It's better to say, just imagine he's going to notice, find out somehow, what are you going to do in that situation? Because then they are prepared. Otherwise, I've had it a couple of times where they essentially say the treatment hasn't worked, and then the wife rings up saying this hasn't worked, my partner says so, but I know the real driving dynamic is that he doesn't want it to work because he was never in favor of it in the first place. But it's complicated. The other one that I love, the three-person consultation, is there's a cheerleader who's neutral but positive. Like, you know, that works really well. And also if they respond really well to the treatment, that makes things so much easier. Mm-hmm. An anxious patient who's with a best friend who wants them to be happy, and the best friend is encouraging all the way through. It's like, oh, you're so grateful for those people who are on that side, because it makes it just creates a positive aura around the whole experience versus being alone and worried about being judged and all the stuff that people have going on. So the only problem is it's very hard to systematize that. Although I do know one doctor whose wife worked with him in clinic room and did something like that seemed to work quite well, being a cheerleader for the whole process. But I've never successfully done that.
Yeah.
What do you think, looking back at what you've learned so far, there's a question I quite like asking people. What do you think, looking back maybe 3 years to 3 years back, what do you think has been your biggest learning so far in aesthetics? The biggest thing that wasn't as you'd expected it to be, or the most useful idea that you refer back to?
You know, I think it goes back to the purpose of this conversation is, you know, you could teach me the anatomy, you could teach me the pathophysiology, you could teach me how a neuromodulator works. I think that's a skill that, you know, every great injector and any great clinician will just inevitably have. But it's that soft skill of just understanding people that I found the hardest. Because again, I came into this with a lot of my own stereotypes and stigmas. And for me, naturally, as an individual, if I'm unclear, hesitant, or want to challenge something, I'll throw myself into it to learn more about it. And, you know, I think my partner, he really inspired me to kind of explore more of this aesthetic industry as a nurse, because, you know, I would ask him, and I will obviously happily say this is, you know, when he first started getting Botox, filler, microneedling for his, you know, teenage deep acne scars that are still present now in his 30s. You know, I was like, oh, I was like, why do we need to do that? Like, you're handsome the way that you are. You're great the way that you are now. Like, why change that? But even in that interaction, when he first got everything and how confident he felt after, you know, the third treatment of microneedling and saw that a lot of his scarring has gone away, or that he just feels more natural and more himself, you know, I think that was the hardest part for me to learn and understand and really shift my perspective of, I'm not just doing this to, you know, put Botox in someone's face and, you know, hopefully that their wrinkles won't turn into deep static wrinkles down the line. But the hardest part to learn was really, how do you navigate these conversations and very personal and very vulnerable conversations with clients, for whatever reason they're coming to get Botox, and really understanding them as people and what will make them confident. I think that was probably the hardest thing to learn, because you can't teach that. It just happens organically and naturally through those consultations and those interactions. And I will say masseter was probably the scariest thing, because of, again, your smile is the first thing people see. And if you have one lopsided smile because you hit the resorius, it's, you know, it's a game over. So again, thank you for your tip of going lower. It's something I tell everyone who's an injector, if they're doing masseters for the first time, of, rather than going to the edge of the lip, like, watch this video from Tim. Like, you have to do it this way to make sure that you're in the safe zone.
I love that, the story you just told through your partner, because I've actually learned a lot. A lot of the deeper stuff you only learn through people you know really well, because you're not part of the experience once they leave your office until it's someone that you know really well. And to do it with your partner, you pick up the deeper internal transformation, which is actually what I think it's all about. So I love that idea that you could look at him from the outside and say, I love you the way you are, you're perfect, don't need to do anything. But they have a different perception. But when they correct it, that you actually see the internal change, and then it all makes sense. That's something. So I was years into aesthetics before Miranda had her lips done. And when she had her lips done, she had this unexpected response that I'd never had from a female patient. I think probably because, like, it's just not appropriate to tell your male doctor, like, how sexy you feel afterwards. But it was okay for her because she was my wife. So she just told me all about it. And I was like, why has that not gone into my thick skull, that this is all about feminine empowerment and feeling sexy, right? And having that power to, you know, to basically feel sexy. It's not about perfect rules and ratios, although that's how you might achieve it. My brain was like trying to turn this into mathematics. And actually, a huge part of it was around just feeling sexy. And that was such a useful thing to understand, which I only got through the experience of someone close to me having a treatment, of seeing what it clicks in their mind, that makes them excited about life again, really. Because I think if you restore, that's like getting to zero. But beyond restoration, to become more beautiful and more sexy, that adds spice to your life, which is much more, in many ways, is more valuable than just being neutral. And the medical model is more around getting people to neutral, fixing the problem. Mm-hmm. Whereas actually aesthetics is interesting, because we take people beyond fixing the problem into a better way of being, more self-confidence. So I love that you've picked that up from listening to your partner's experience.
Yeah. And again, it goes back to when you feel better and look better, you are able to bring a better self to the table, whether that be in your intimate relationships, your work. I think, I don't want to say that it feels superficial or vain to say, but truly, when you feel confident, whether it's in, like, in your skills and how you look, you just do a better job, and you're able to walk into a space 100% your authentic self and give your whole self into that. And, you know, I had a client who, they had used their joint card to make the appointment and to pay. But she was very much like, oh, I don't want to be on Instagram. I don't want anyone to know. And then eventually, somewhere down the line for the next treatment, their partner was there. And he said, yeah, I just don't understand this. And, you know, I really put it back on the client to say, she feels beautiful. That's all you need to know. That's all that this is. You know, it's not changing the way that she looks. It's making her feel beautiful. And I think that's something that we all can agree on, and how we choose to present and how we choose to feel beautiful in this world.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I love about that is if you actually ask people what's going on in their mind when they're more when they feel more beautiful, is they're actually not thinking about themselves as much. They're actually thinking more about connecting with other people. Mm-hmm. And this is another key word that I think is really helpful to understand is, I think the driving force for a lot of procedures is people wanting to connect better with others. And for that, they need to rid themselves of some of whatever they think is creating, what creates the internal friction in their head. An insecurity, a doubt, a sense of maybe, you know, I've got some acne scarring or something that is in your mind instead of just connecting. Mm-hmm. It holds people back from that connection. So this is, I think, a very useful idea to think about all your patients wanting to connect better by removing some internal friction. And then beyond internal friction is actually feeling like, no, I'm in such a positive state that I can't wait to connect with as many people as possible, to build relationships, to collaborate. And for me, that makes it seem, it's so much healthier than the idea that you're correcting in order that people look at you or that you get attention. It's really not that at all. Most people are just readying themselves to actually go and give. And that's what my patients will tell me when I say, how's your behavior changed after having this treatment? They'll say, oh, everything. Like I'm better. I'm a better mum. I'm a better, you know, better at work. I'm a better, whatever it is in their, whatever situation they put themselves in, they feel stronger and healthier in that situation. And for me, that's the bottom line. That's what it's all about. We're empowering people to be stronger, which is what we all need as a society. You need strong people to make things happen, to create things, people who are supporting others and helping other people grow. Those tend to be the strong people. They don't tend to be the people who are held back. So the more of those people, the better. And it's really, we should be thinking about aesthetics in that level of, we're empowering individuals to give more to other individuals, which makes all of us better off.
Yeah, and I think, you know, my life outside of aesthetics, I work in transplants, so it's a very different environment. I grew up as a nurse in the operating room doing open heart transplants. And, you know, I think that's where my meticulous nature comes from, and kind of the very data driven, very methodical nature. But aesthetics, like you said, is very far different than, you know, what other healthcare industries or healthcare specialties look like, because again, we're getting them to neutral. We're getting them to a place that they're stable enough to live their lives, which is a different shift in mindset to the aesthetic industry of, I'm not getting them to ground zero, but like you said, we're empowering them to get rid of some of their foundational insecurities, whatever that may be, so that they can come into this world a more holistic individual. And that was something I also had to relearn too, going into aesthetics from my background, was, you know, we are able to do more, and we are able to not necessarily fix someone, but we're able to give them back something that they didn't have before. And that could be confidence, that could be beauty, that could be, you know, one less wrinkle on their forehead, whatever it may be. But I think that's so important for all of us clinicians to remember, is that our role is not to fix someone. Our role is to empower them, to make them feel like themselves, and to really amplify the beauty that they already have.
Yeah. I think one of the hardest things for people on the outside to understand is when someone is already beautiful, but they want, in fact, we have it with Layla, who I'm sure you won't mind me saying. So she's only 31. She's had a few treatments you'll see on the YouTube. And one of the most frequent comments we get is that she doesn't need it. And for me, that's an interesting word, need. Like, who decides what someone needs? And is it valid to just want something as well? And a lot of that, I think, is a lot of this issue that we're discussing is somewhere around that philosophy of, should people have a procedure unless they need it? And what does need mean? What's wrong with wanting it and being more beautiful, just so that you can do more stuff? Like, even though there's nothing wrong with your face, it's very hard for people to understand that you could have a procedure when there's nothing wrong with your face. And actually, that's most of our patients, if you think of it. Mm-hmm. It's very rare to have someone who's actually got something wrong. Yeah. It tends to be usually that you were just freshening them up and making them look better. I think it's quite a hard thing for people to grasp. And even clinicians in this industry, I don't know if because you might have it, because you're 29 and you might have a, you know, a matriarch in her 50s going, what are you doing, Kev? You don't need it. And, you know, talk to that a little bit around the difference in want and need, and how you talk about that with your patients maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we get to the conversation of need, it's a far different conversation. Like, oh, I need this to get rid of my wrinkles. I need this because I have heaviness or adipose tissue, and that's a more surgical technique. I think it's easy to talk about need in the sense of, you know, you really don't need it because that's not what you're trying to achieve. But I think the want is definitely a lot harder because that gets more into their psyche, into that foundational idea of why they want this. And that could be deeply rooted in, you know, whatever history they have around aesthetics or, you know, how they perceive and look at themselves. But to your point, and I think that's so important, is who am I to tell you, Tim, or you, Layla, what you want? I think that's also the downside of social media, is that in some ways, with a hyper-connected world, we've all become hyper-critical about each other's choices. And I think that's also what leads to people being hesitant, because, you know, you see an Instagram story of somebody one day, 2 weeks later, you're like, oh, wait, where did that wrinkle come from? Like, we've all become hyper-critical of each other, and immediately we'll want to go to the path of like, oh, why did they get this? Why did they get that? But again, who am I to decide what you want? You know, I'm here to educate you of the areas that are riskier and why we don't treat certain areas a certain way. But I'm not here to tell you or anybody really out there, any of my clients, what they want out of this, because that's such a personal decision. And when a client comes to me saying like, I want to feel like myself, I want to feel like I did before the pandemic because I'm a nurse and I've been holding so much tension in my forehead because no one's been able to see my mouth covered up by a mask. You know, their want is valid to me. The reason that they come to me is valid. And I think it's really important for all of us to respect why people come to us. Again, we may not disagree. We may not agree with the areas that they may want to get treated because of our own perception of them. Or we, you know, may disagree because those are areas that we can't treat. But my role is to respect why they want it.
Yeah, I love that. I think there's a really interesting thing which you're also trying to tread the line with, which is it's okay for, essentially, a want is the heart of what makes individuals different. If you actually think about what's different about you versus me, like one of the main things is we want different things. If we wanted exactly the same thing, there would be no difference between us. In many ways. So to respect individuals is about respecting what they want. Now, you can also say there comes a point where the thing you want is not something I want to be involved with. Mm-hmm. I don't disrespect you for wanting it, but I can say I'm not going to take part in it. And that's a really subtle line between saying, because a lot of clinicians will, when a patient asks for something that is going to downgrade them, will judge the patient and say the patient is stupid for wanting that. And it's quite a tricky thing to walk both lines of saying, I'm going to put a boundary down, but I'm going to do it without judging you. Because who knows, maybe you would be happier with, you know, one of the biggest sets of cheeks in the world. I don't know for sure, but I don't have enough certainty about that to back myself. And I don't want to be involved in things with that kind of risk. So I'm not going to treat you. But it's a very different message to you're an idiot for asking, which is often the implied story. And in fact, it came up recently with Layla asked me to comment on on Japanese children having surgery in their eyelids. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was right at the heart of it. I do not understand Japanese culture. I don't know what it's like being a child growing up in Tokyo. So how can I make a judgment about whether wanting that is bad for your child or not? I'm not informed on it. So the most I can say is I wouldn't do that with my current situation. I wouldn't be involved in it, but I don't judge people who will, because it's too, I have to be humble and realize I don't understand the complexities of that situation without living there. And it's the same with each individual that you treat. And it's the same with your wife, to be honest, or your partner. Like, sometimes you don't understand the complexity of what they want. And it's only when they pursue it and achieve it do you realize whether they were right or not, which is actually your story in a nutshell, which is you actually discovered the real value as he'd gone through the process, which validated the want in the first place, because he was happier at the end.
Exactly.
So that's a lovely point to get to, I think. And I think that's going to help a lot of our listeners be clearer with their patients around guiding them, helping them get what they want when it's appropriate, maybe not maybe guiding them against it when they don't think what they want is actually going to, well, the request is different to what they want. This is also gets very interesting. Sometimes people request things that is actually not in alignment with what they want. And you've touched on that as well. But this is the heart of a good consultation. So it's really good to have this all recorded.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we're not going to change the world overnight, but what we can change and what we can empower and impact are those individual conversations that we have with patients through consultations, treatments, or even just on Instagram when you're going back and forth in the DMs or on comments is, you know, making sure that we're not coming from a judgmental or hypercritical space. And there's already enough of that around aesthetics and beauty in our industry that why do we actively contribute to that? And again, like I said, I'm so grateful to not only chat with the legend and icon himself, but to have this platform that reaches so many clinicians and patients to say, hey, this is what we're doing in aesthetics. This is also what we're not doing through it, is such an important message that I think we need to continue to deliver through all of our social media platforms as clinicians. Because, you know, technique is great and talking about how to reduce the risk of an adverse event is great. But I think that builds credibility in the sense like you have the skill, but what is building credibility? And this is a shout out to Miranda, like what's building credibility with you as a person and what you value and what you're bringing to this industry. So I think having more conversations like this with fellow clinicians or even patients themselves is so important because it only really moves that pendulum towards the right direction and really dispels some of those stigmas and stereotypes that really challenge individuals and make them hesitant of seeking out something that may honestly make them feel confident and make them feel beautiful. I think we also have to realize that Botox is still very new and kind of this aesthetic industry is still deeply rooted in fixing people's insecurities. I don't think that's something that we'll ever remove. But what we can change and what we can, you know, really change the trajectory of within our industry is how we talk about beauty, how we talk about aesthetic treatments as a not a way to fix somebody, but to renew somebody's sense of self.
I love that. That's probably a great place to finish. Great take-home message. Can I ask you one other thing, which I'm asking everyone here, which I think might be more interesting as time goes on to look back on, which is we've talked a little bit about what you've learned looking back. If you to now, because what I detect in you is a lot of energy, a really good ethos, and I suspect you're going places. I would like to know, where would you like to be going? If you said 3 years time, what would you like life to be like for you with regard to aesthetics or the rest of your career? I'm interested to hear.
It's funny, I was listening to the podcast you did with Dan again, and how he wanted to be the face of Candid. Like, you know, I'm a vision boarder. I like to manifest things. And I had texted my friend the other day, I was like, I want to be the face of inclusive aesthetics. You know, I think where I see our industry going is much like a lot of, you know, fashion, beauty industries that are creating more inclusive, accessible, diverse, you know, product lines. I think that will be the same for aesthetics. It may just take a little bit longer because, you know, there's still that deeply rooted fear around it. But, you know, I really hope that having more conversations like this will really create a more inclusive and diverse environment because, you know, wrinkles, I tell a lot of my patients who are of color, like wrinkles don't discriminate. Yeah, you know, we can talk about melanin and how, you know, darker melanated skin, you know, ages differently over time. But if you're moving your muscles, you're making expressions, you're going to have wrinkles. Like this industry does not discriminate and nor should we. I think we need to create a space that is open, honest, authentic, and vulnerable for all patients to come in with their wants, their needs, and, you know, talking truthfully about why they're wanting to get what they're getting. So my hope is that through the course of my career and through the course of treating patients that we create a more inclusive environment. And, you know, hopefully this is the beginning of that trend in the right direction for you, me, other clinicians, and, you know, patients to come.
That is great. And I love that you were triggered to commit to that goal through Dan's podcast, because that's the thing. Well, I think a lot of the best stuff in life happens in those moments of realizing that even if it seems like a far off goal, or maybe that other people wouldn't want it. Like we've touched on, it's quite likely that other people wouldn't want the same thing, that it's your goal. And that's all you need to know. And then you just need to start forming the strategy and the actions that will bring you closer to it. And you may also discover along the way that there's an even bigger or more important or a different goal that you want to pursue. But the point is, you now have direction about what you need to do. And that's one of the things I try and do for anyone I come in touch with. I'm kind of weirdly obsessed with it. it's just to help people see where their journey lies. And I love that you've got that from the podcast already. And I look forward, if there's anything we can do to help you with your goal, then it so happens that you're already doing it. So that's I think it's working really well at the moment. You're already on your way, because probably thousands of people will listen to this, and I'm sure it's going to make many of them think and probably change some behavior, and off you go.
Yeah. And, you know, again, thank you all for the opportunity to not only be here and speak with you, but to share this message. Again, one podcast isn't going to change it, but one podcast can trigger the change. You know, it can really be the stone that you throw in a stale pond and really cause a ripple effect. So I'm really excited to see how we'll all grow together and how our industry will grow. And I'll continue to learn such amazing things from both you and Miranda. And, you know, for anybody listening, you follow both of them, because I think the dynamic of the two of y'all is just incredible. And y'all have taught not only myself, but thousands of other clinicians around the globe so many important skills, and whether they be the art or science of the aesthetic industry. So thank you all for everything that you're doing for our community.
Thank you. And where can our followers keep up to date with your progress?
Yeah, y'all can follow me on Bachar Beauty. That's kind of the main hub, but the greater company that I work with is Persimmon Life. So you can definitely direct yourself to my Instagram and then find the greater company there.
Thank you very much, Nurse KB. Kevin, it's been a pleasure having you. Great to connect with you. And I'm sure we'll talk again one day.
Yes, we'll talk soon, Tim. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.